And sometimes it helps to massage your knees or the muscles just above the knees with the heels of your hand. Good, I'd like to ask for your attention. By my reckoning, meditation is something like an art. It's not a religion, it's not a technique, it's not a devotional practice. It's something like an art. The closest I come to this art is, I guess, what a relationship is. You know, you can't say only one thing is right in a relationship. You know, if you're in a relationship, it means you're going to attune yourself to what's happening, what's needed, what's not happening. You can't expect it to be one particular way only, and you need to have more than one trick to make it continue. Sometimes it will feel great and sometimes it will not feel great. Sometimes you wish there would be more of it there, and sometimes you wish, why is this person so important in my life? Yeah. So after many years of meditation, this is probably the closest that I come to understand the fundamental art or the fundamental skill that is necessary in meditation is the willingness, the ability, and the attunement in such a relationship. I would even go further and say the crucial element of meditation, or the most instrumental element, very much praised here in recent years, called mindfulness, is actually in a nutshell, is a relational skill. Now, for many of you, this is probably not surprising. It's the things that are transformative in our lives are generally relational. The things that make us grow are generally relational. So it's probably not a surprise that the most core part of meditation practice also has a strong relational component. The problem with relation and life itself is that often this experience we have in a relationship differs from notions we think we should have in that experience. Gregory Bateson, not a Buddhist, polymath and somewhat dated by now, but still a very formative man, said that most people's suffering arises from the discrepancy between the way the world works and the way we think about the world. This sounds very simplistic, but if I was going to go under my Buddhist hat, I would say much of that definition actually holds up as a definition for suffering. The discrepancy between what I expect and what I actually experience. How good I negotiate that discrepancy. Not whether there is such a discrepancy. I assume there will always be. To be frank with you, I don't expect this discrepancy to go away. What I think, so it's not so much how little suffering we get. The question is how good we handle whatever we get. The question is, you know, how subtle does the universe how subtle can the universe become in giving us hints of suffering and how willing we are to learn? Or how big the clubs are needed before we're willing to actually pick up some learning skills? Yeah. So basically, the task seems to be to suffer more elegantly. Yeah? to suffer, to insist on less suffering because before our learning skills kind of kick in. So if you translate that into relationship, obviously that's what we learn in relationship, isn't it? We learn not to go off the road completely. We learn to take hints. We learn to become more subtle in stating our needs or stating our dislikes or picking up hints or dislikes from the other side. So this is what we're trying to do in meditation. Think of this as something big. Don't think of this as a technique. Techniques won't get us enlightened. In fact, the major issue for me as a meditation teacher is that people are quite happy to pick up skills, they're quite happy to follow orders, they're quite happy to do tricks, but actually the most difficult thing is to find out what I'm already doing. Yeah. Because generally that's what brings us to meditation. I don't actually want to be where I am. I don't want to be who I am. I don't want to experience what I experience. So please, you Buddhists, you meditation teachers, give me a trick that I don't have to do all this. Yeah. My wish secretly is I wish not to have what I have. Yeah. So give me something that takes me away. It's the kind of Star Trek version of Buddhism, yeah? Scotty, beam me up kind of thing. Yeah? Beam me out of my reality. Give me something which is better than what I am currently experiencing. And you have some drugs, you have some tricks, you know some stuff to do that. The bad news is, no, I don't have drugs, I don't have tricks. The sort of pills I can sell you are the very kind of pills that actually encourage you to take a closer look at what already is happening. That is a public relationship issue we have as Buddhists. We have a lot of people who don't want to have what they experience. Then we gradually have to tell them, actually, that's where they need to start from. Yeah? We don't replace their experiences, though there are powerful ways of making other experiences possible. Fundamentally, we'll need to go back to what we're already doing and figure out how exactly we're doing this. Because if we are doing it, and that's a Buddhist premise, we are doing our experience, we're not having it as passive victims, you know, being inflicted upon us by a cruel world or bad gods or ill-tempered governments. We're actually making our own experience. We make it by a variety of moves. Some of these moves are intentional, what we want. Some of these moves are perceptual, how we frame what's happening. Some of these moves, most potently, are attentional. It's where our attention goes. Where our attention goes is what defines what our experience is going to be like. In other words, by directing our attention, we form experiences. We form our experience. Yeah. It is very easy. If you don't like beans, if beans don't sit well with your digestive systems, you try to avoid beans. Yeah. So we all know that. We all know how to avoid certain foods which are not good for us. The same would actually apply with our attentional diet. Certain things are not very suitable to our systems. They don't make us happy. They don't make us feel our power. They don't give us good feelings. They are not providing us with clarity and other skills that make this mind more clear. So if we keep putting those things into our system, it's unlikely that our system will have other experiences than the ones we already know. It's very simple. But while we're quite skilled in dietary circumspection, stay off glutens or get rid of the beans in our, you know, or don't do sugars, or, you know, we're quite disciplined when it comes to forms of diet. We're not so disciplined when it comes to attentional forms of diet. So one of the things we need to find out is what actually helps us to become more clear. Clarity being the basis of that which makes the heart free of its constrictions. We don't need to change the program. We need to find out how the program works. We need to get into the software shed, Yeah. The software shed, this is where the matrix is hashed out. Yeah. So rather than getting a better matrix, we need to actually find a way to get at the code. We need to get in there. And the only way to find that out is by finding out what we're doing. Which is why many of you are probably here in the first place, because they don't want to find out what they're doing. Because you want to get something different, so you don't have to find out what you're doing. I find myself still, after 30 years of meditation, that tendency is still there. I cannot really believe it. Whenever I notice it has come to the fore, I give my best to stay away from that belief. But the tendency as a dormant inclination is still there. You know, give me something better. Give me something else. Rather than have me find out what I'm doing here and how I could do something more skillful. Just the simple childlike wish, could it not be otherwise? Yeah. Could it not be otherwise? Mm-hmm. Could I be less tired, less grumpy, less stressed, less anxious, less greedy, less just anything, whatever you... Fill in your blank. Yeah? Fill in your favorite unliked mood. Yeah. So, meditation actually has powerful tools as soon as we're willing to relate what's happening. So the first skill in meditation is that we orient towards present tense experience. That already is a challenge, because often that present tense experience has a tone that is unpleasant, a tone that is not welcomed by our internalized value structures. It says, this kind of experience is not the sort of experience I am willing to engage with. It doesn't probably say it that clearly, because if it's that clearly stated, you know, it sounds grotesque, doesn't it? Yeah. You have this wonderful saying in English language, we're not having this conversation. Yeah. I've always, as a sort of continental who can't say the same thing with the same economy, you know, I've always found, what a powerful statement. What a powerful statement to, when I have my little argument with the world, you know, I simply say, listen, universe, we're not having this conversation. Yeah. And however affirmative you say that, it doesn't work, is it? We are having this conversation, yeah? We're embarked, you know, we're embodied, we've incarnated, you know, it's happening. Bodies are happening, moods are happening, governments are happening, families are happening. Who has really chosen his or her family, you know? Who has not kind of sighed, how have I been settled with these people? You know? Why have I been cursed with that kind of sibling? You know, my longest standing relationship, likely in this incarnation, is generally your siblings, isn't it? You're together with them for longer than with your partners usually. They're there when you get born, and they may be there when you die. So, and yet you can't get away. You can't divorce siblings. You can't quit siblings. You can't. So there you are, and you're settled with a situation in which you can make a good job of it, you can make a bad job of it, you can be a nice brother, a stupid sister, you can be a callous elder sibling, or an ungrateful younger one, you can be all kinds of things, but you can't get away from being one. Yeah. So the challenge seems to be how we can be more deeply here. That's how we can be more deeply in the stuff that we're in. How we can engage more deeply, relate more deeply, understand more deeply what we're already in, rather than try to get beamed out, you know, beamed away from, taken out of. While the longing is understandable, and there's still a kind of, as I confessed, a longing still there, sometimes that I simply be taken out, you know, by some gracious Deus ex machina, taken out of my little situation and epiphany, you know, the curtain opens and Helios comes and pulls me out, or Mother Mary, or, you know, Kibele or whatever your favorite deity is, that I'm not having this conversation with the universe I'm just having right now. And yet, we know this is kind of not happening, is it? It's not happening in my life, I suspect it's not happening in yours. And the thing that makes growth possible is my willingness to keep relating, to keep having this conversation. So there's no secret in this, and meditation is a way to deepen that relationship and to infuse that relationship with a strength and the capacity of learning in there that takes us beyond the habitual convulsions. The convulsions I would call the attempt to maximize good feeling by moving towards things that feel good. And a convulsion I would also call the insistence to move away from things that give us bad feelings or that feel unpleasant. Now this is something very, very simple and very, very old. You have a couple of amino acids, very simple structure of life, long before it does complicated things like oxygen breathing or sexuality or things like that. Just a couple of amino acids, you know. If it's something good for this, if this creature feels good, if it feels it's moving into something that is pleasant or nourishing, it'll propel its little flagellae towards the thing that is nice and pleasant. And if it's unpleasant or slightly toxic, it'll move away from. Yeah? Very, very simple. This moving towards, moving away from. Fundamental force of life. You can find that right down. Yeah? Can't get it a lot more simple than a couple of amino acids. That same principle still holds true for us who are a bit more complex. Still amino acids, but a bit, say, more bulky kind of type of amino acid. Higher primates, vertebrates, unfettered bipeds, as Plato calls them. This is still a principle that is very rampant. It's very rampant in the economy of our attention. Much of our attention is basically organized around the principle of pleasure, of agreeableness, which we hope to maximize, both in time and in intensity, by moving towards things and sticking to things that give us those feelings, and by trying to avoid things that give us the opposite type of feelings. A very simple dimension of experience Buddhist psychology calls vedana. We don't have a proper term for this in English, but we know exactly what it means. It's a mental quality. It's the evaluation of an event in my experience, a thought, a sound, a body feeling, a taste, a visual sensation. The evaluation of that experience as agreeable, as pleasant, as interesting, as giving some sort of satisfaction. And obviously the opposite type, which is the evaluation that says this is not nice, this is not pleasant, this is not agreeable, this is not interesting, this does not give satisfaction. Now, this evaluation is not fixed. Now, if you eat a plate of lovely spaghetti carbonara after you've done a hard day's work, then that plate, when it comes towards you, is a lot more giving you pleasant feelings than after you've eaten two of those plates and your neighbor gets his plate a little later than you. Yeah. So the agreeableness of the visual sight and the anticipation of what that tastes like and what that does to your system is a lot higher before you've had your two plates than after you've had your two plates. So that value I'm speaking of is not fixed as a value. And yet, the fact that we seek the pleasant over the unpleasant and studiously try to avoid that is a constant in our experience. How we get the pleasant into our system, we differ quite a bit. Conditioning, age, tastes vary, but we generally favor the things that give us good feelings. And we generally try to avoid the things that give us bad feelings. Sometimes we do complicated things. we make us feel good by punishing us by having something bad so that we feel better because the punishment feels a deserved thing. So we, you know, sometimes we do kind of little numbers on ourselves. But basically, the principle holds. We try to maximize what feels good, pleasant, agreeable, and we try to move away from what is the opposite. Now, much of our attention is governed by this principle. If you're not actually training your attention, then most of your attention is either geared by survival. Yeah, this is called involuntary attention, or at least psychology calls it that. And the Western tradition has started to identify that, you know, as early as you find that in Aristotle, where he describes that, you know, you could read your book, and then suddenly a loud sound takes your mind away right from the book and goes out to what you don't see. So you lose what you see in favor of a sudden and loud auditory experience. So he acknowledges the involuntary power, sudden, intense, unexpected sensory experience has over our voluntary attention, which we have maybe decided to give to a particular activity like reading. This sounds abstract, but this is one of the reasons why little children get screamed at. Yeah. It's very hard to focus your attention on what you're doing when you get screamed at. There's something deeply inbred. If people scream at you, then you give them your attention. This is politically not correct, it's pedagogically discouraged, and yet it's just very effective. Yeah. So, despite the known discouragement of that activity, it keeps happening. Yeah. And why does it keep happening? Because if you enrage another fellow human being to the extent by not giving him or her your attention, this being at some point actually might decide to use that well-proven technique and to get your attention and just raises his or her voice. And then, lo and behold, you know, she or he will get your attention because you can't help yourself doing what you have been groomed to do by evolution, namely anything sudden, anything unexpected, anything intense enough will get attention. That has helped us survive against, you know, saber-toothed tigers, this kind of thing. But this kind of involuntary attention, if survival is not an issue, is easily bored. This kind of attention is kind of scanning the horizons for events. It says, well, I'm here. What is on offer? You know, what's happening here? Where could I get the nice bit? With whom could I sit? What could I eat? Is there something to watch, something to think about, something to do, something to listen to? Yeah. Who's got the nicest smile? Where could I go with my attention? Yeah. So if that kind of involuntary attention is not preoccupied with survival, if there's nothing to survive right now because it's safe, then that kind of attention is on the constant lookout for amusement, for gratification. Yeah. So that's the tendency, that's the pattern. I haven't invented that. You can verify that easily in your experience. This is the kind of mind we have to deal with if we sit down and want to wake up. This kind of mind, either it's preoccupied with a particular situation, a particular emotion, or if it's not preoccupied, it will wonder what it could enjoy, what would be nice, what's on offer right now in the sense fields. Yeah? If nothing's on offer, it says, well, okay, they're all quiet, you know, he's meditated. You know. Some are smiling, some are not. Nothing to eat yet, another 2 hours to go. You know. Well, you go back into your mind and you rummage around and you find at least a pleasant memory or an attractive fantasy. And you see whether you can kind of chew it a bit, see whether it yields some more chews, you know, an afterglow of your breakfast, you know, how that coffee tasted this morning, you know, that caramel macchiato. Maybe I can go back there tomorrow. You know, you connect the memory of the taste with the anticipation of, yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, connect pleasant experience of the past with future possibilities. That gives me good feeling. It connects a very pleasant memory with a possible prospect and a sense of empowerment. Yes, I can afford that now. I deserve this kind of pleasure now. I know there's a purse somewhere over there, and I know there's enough coins in there to give me another caramel macchiato tomorrow. So I get a pleasant memory, a pleasant anticipation, and the reassuring sense I have the power or the possibility to do that again for me. So this gets me through another 2 minutes of this. I think you get, it's a slight caricature, and I suspect you'll be more complex and complicated than that, and forgive me if I simplify this a little bit, but you recognize the pattern. So much of our attention, if not preoccupied by surviving, which is an evolutionary process has gotten us where we are, is looking for pleasant stimulation. The intensity of that stimulation and the kind of that stimulation, we may vary, but the fact that we are on the lookout for this is a dominant force in the economy of where our attention goes. Now, Buddhists and other yogic forms of meditation training have easily understood that this type of attention is not much use. It's endless, The preoccupations and the investment of our attention into such things, they may increase our range of available coffees and things like that. They may increase our refinement in sensory pleasures. And if you look at the development of trade routes or economical development in world history, you'll see this is a powerful force. Yeah, mm-hmm. People didn't go over to India to find out about Buddhist teaching. They went over there for the paperbacks. Yeah, mm-hmm. Very clear. So the pursuit of such kinds of pleasure have been profound motors in world history and world economy. So there is a tremendous strength in this, but it doesn't actually seem to make individuals correspondingly happy. Yeah? Our culture here in the West are probably the best examples. We are more affluent than most other societies. We have more material well-being than most other places in the world. We are the privileged lot. Education and thriving economies, and obviously we're never happy with it. And but still, if we compare to other places, this is the good corner. And yet, we don't seem to be correspondingly happy. Yeah. Much could be said against the attempt to equate material well-being with happiness. We don't seem to be that happy if you look at the consumption of drugs. I'm speaking of legal drugs. I'm not speaking of off-license use. I'm speaking of psychopharmaca. If you look at the suicide rates, if you look at the how many people declare themselves to be depressed if you make random interviews in the road? Yeah? There seems to be no clear correlation between material affluence and the well-being of a society if you look by the usual anthropological parameters. In fact, we seem to be quite a miserable lot, on the whole. The more affluent we seem to get, the happiness does not actually seem to increase. Although the wealth increases, the support increases, life expectancy increases, comfort increases, health rates increase, we don't actually seem to match that with subjectively experienced happiness. Yeah? So the attempt to be happy and content and feel good by doing the things that make us feel good does not work out. Yeah? We all know that. Yeah. It's a bit stark if I spell it out that way, but we all instinctively know that by just getting more of the good stuff doesn't actually make us more happy. In fact, it can be reverse. Yeah? We can feel less safe even though we're objectively more secure. We may have more money or more pensions or more locks on our door, and yet we may still feel more anxious and insecure inside those locks, yeah? Surrounded by our lovely things. We may, because these feelings do not correlate to objective realities. They do correlate to an internal representational value system, which is wildly disconnected from objective realities. Yeah. So if we want to be happy, it's one thing to look at objective values, you know, having governments that builds bridges and schools and hospitals and looks after its people, that's one thing, and that's a good thing. But it doesn't actually guarantee that the people who have all these things done for them are going to be happy in there. They may still be feeling that they're losing out. They may still feel that they pay too many taxes. They may still feel that they don't get enough, or the government is bloated, is not efficient, and you know, other governments may have been better, or this government could be better, although other governments have been worse. You know, we do not reciprocate the objective increase in good feelings, in comfort, in safety, with a subjective appreciation and corresponding happiness. We do not. We're quite capable of being miserable and surrounded by good things that yesterday were making us happy, but today we feel they're not good enough. So that part of us which generates happiness from good feelings is capable infinitely more of growth than we could fill it up or feed it with external positive feelings. Yeah? In other words, our capacity for discontent is higher than our capacity for appreciation. It's no secret, you know, neurologists know about this. It's called negative perceptual bias. It means it helps us remind the things that do not work out in our lives that feel bad, that we try avoiding to repeat this experience. Yeah? You eat bad mushrooms, you're happy enough to survive the experience, you're likely to tell your children, and evolutionary this is an advantage. Yeah? You having survived this experience, bad experience, it will leave an indelible mark, you know, 3 days with a sick stomach. You will tell your offspring. Offspring will stay away from those mushrooms. You know, this is an evolutionary advantage. Makes a lot of sense. But if you want to be happy, it doesn't make a lot of sense. Yeah. If you want to be happy, you need to actually affirm the stuff that is good in your life. And this very same principle that looks for the survival of our species is actually a bad principle if this species wants to be a happy species. So we need to affirm positive stuff. And that is not just a nice thought we need to think, you know, how safe we are, what good things we have enjoyed. There are practices, even Buddhist practices, who do that. The practice I'm speaking to you about is more radical and kicks in earlier. It starts right at the beginning of attention, not just the appreciation bit after your attention has savored something nice, but we need to actually stir the capacity to direct our attention in another direction, away from this maximizing what feels good, minimizing what feels bad pattern, to a deliberate type of attention. That's where Buddhist and yogic meditation teachings kick in. They say, you know, we can choose, rather than wait for attention to be pulled out by either nice things or by people screaming at us, yeah, we can actually give attention. We can deliberately choose where our attention goes, how it stays there, and what it does there. We can choose. But obviously, while that sounds easy enough, it's completely counterintuitive. It goes against the grain of our patterning, our evolutionary patterning, our pleasure seeking and avoiding displeasure pattern. And that's why meditation is not easy. That's why it's an art. Because we need to unclutch our attention from that deal. Love it, like it, lots of attention, lots of availability. No, this is not nice. no, this doesn't flatter my perceptions. This is not who I am. Thank you very much. I'm not having this conversation back. Yeah? We need to unlearn this type of patterning. And that's what meditation does. It says, listen, I'm going to choose something because it happens, not because it's nice, but I'm going to give by choice my attention to something that is happening, and I'm doing that because it is already happening, not because it's nice, or because it might get less nice than it is and I'm taking it away. I choose to go there, and by choosing so, I strengthen not just my relationship to that experience and may learn something about it, but I also learn how to direct experience and thereby have a much bigger say in what is my experience. Because where my attention goes, that becomes my experience. Where my attention goes, my energies goes. My perceptions will form around. And that will become my world. So if our attention is taken away by either people who have learned to grab our attention, there's many people out there who have trained in that, highly paid people who are really good at knowing how to grab your attention. And while they try to sell you latte macchiato, they actually try to promise you all kinds of things. They try to not promise you latte macchiato, they try to promise you happiness. They try to promise you fulfillment. They try to promise you contentment. Yeah? Nobody sells you latte macchiato out there if they want to sell you macchiato. Yeah? It's an old story. You don't sell the steak, you sell the sizzle, isn't it? That's what it says. So we learn to get some of that attention back. We learn to become the forgings of our own happiness by actually taking responsibility where this attention goes, where we wish it to go. And we let it go there because we have found out it's helpful for us to go there where we have found, where we choose to go. Yeah? So that is the bigger framework of these little exercises. Right now, I would like to suggest we stand up for a minute and do some standing practice.